Hello, heroes. Welcome to Modifier. I'm your host, Megan Dornbrock. This episode, I talked to Glenn Gibbon, one of the three designers behind Games by Playdate. They've made the games Slash, Pack the Pack, Bad Habit, and are right now kickstarting their storytelling card game, Hearts Blazing. Once we got talking, it was really hard to stop. Glenn is a great, thoughtful guy, and we had a wonderful time talking about storytelling, games, and why it's important to smash the boundaries we erect between those things, and as well as between the subtypes of those things. Just lots of boundary smashing. We also talked about Hearts Blazing and its campaign, and a bit about their other game, Slash. So what I'm presenting here is the slightly abridged version of our chat, but both Glenn and I are more than happy to keep talking about any of this on Twitter. If we make reference to something I cut out, I do apologize. I don't think it happens, but just hit us up if you have any questions. That's enough from me. Let's get to the show.
So one of my favorite designers of games is Avery McDowell, who did Monster Hearts, and she did The Quiet Year, and she did Ribbon Drive, and then she stopped making games. And I think pretty much on every opportunity, I've extolled her virtues. But those were some, especially things like The Quiet Year, were really groundbreaking designs. Monster Hearts is amazing, and Monster Hearts is really good. But at its essence, it is a kind of like a sex emo hack of Apocalypse World.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great, but it's limited to the soil from which it's born out of. Right?
Okay.
Does that make sense? Like,
I'll allow it.
So there's this great essay, not essay, I don't know, maybe blog post or something about what are called fantasy heartbreakers.
Ooh, okay.
So a fantasy heartbreaker is a semi-derogatory term for a game where it's basically some version of Dungeons & Dragons with one or two things that have been changed about it. It's like, it's D&D, okay, but they fixed the magic system, or it's D&D, but they fixed alignments, or it's D&D. Like, whatever. It's all basically that. And so it's these projects that people invested tremendous amounts of love and energy in. And so whether they're good or bad, you should have a baseline respect for the amount of effort that was put into it. But for the most part, they are large, complicated messes. Which is, in a way, far more tragic than if they had been large, complicated messes born whole cloth from the insane minds of the people who were making it, right? Like, I can imagine playing a game and going, I love this game. I wish that the creators of the game had not been so stupid as to fuck up the third level, you know, druid spell Goodberry. Like, that is a myopia that doesn't make great experiences. Or doesn't allow you to create great new art, right? And maybe it's the wrong way.
Okay.
Is that fair? Like, if you were to go, man, I wish Shakespeare used a semicolon better, and then got, like, really pedantic about all the punctuation in Shakespeare. And I'm sure there'd be some really valid points there, because Shakespeare was kind of sloppy grammaticist, but also, who cares?
Yeah. Okay, I see that part of the point. But you do know that Modifier is about people who do that to games, right?
I know, but what that's exactly why I bring it up, though, right? Because there's a way to, like, step back from that myopia and really start making really, really good things, right? So there's the Picasso phrase that good artists are inspired and great artists steal.
Oh, yes.
And I recently was talking with someone who ended up doing demos of the tabletop game 504. Have you seen this thing?
I have not.
God, 504 is right up your alley. So 504 is not, it's barely, I don't know, it's a game. It's a tabletop game, sure. But the conceit of it is that it has all of these interchangeable parts. Right? So it has this kind of three-tiered booklet where you can flip to different sections of the rules and combine, going, this is a territory game where you are picking up and delivering goods that also has an auction mechanic. And you basically, it's like kind of like slots where you're not necessarily randomly, of course you could do it randomly, creating the game from these central concepts, like a trio of central concepts. And the reason it's called 504 is because there's 504 504 possible combinations of the rules.
Oh my God.
Yeah, yeah, you should totally look into it. And the game is boring as fuck, but it's also...
yeah.
It's like, it's not fun, but that doesn't make it unimpressive at all. It's the kind of thing that you want to own, but never want to play.
Okay, that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah, so like, when I was listening to Modifier, I was like, how have you never talked about this? And when you brought up stuff like Apocalypse World, the idea that something Vincent and Meg made has been remixed into a number of really great platforms is really exciting, but also maybe it gets to the point where it's like cyclical, where people are just riffing over and over and over and over about it. And there's some really amazing riffs that come out of it. There's things like Monster Hearts that just blow your mind. But also the comfort of the foundation of Apocalypse World might prevent people from creating new great things.
It's really interesting that you put it like that. One of the episodes that hasn't come out yet, but that I have recorded, is actually all about specifically Apocalypse World hacks. I talked to Andrew Medeiros about how he makes so many Apocalypse World hacks and his approaches to it, and what about the system is appealing? What does he change? Is there any part of the system that's sacred that he can't touch, you know, when he does these things? And the answer is sort of no. Everything is fair game, but something about jumping off from that, I don't know, like, I don't want to spoil that episode in this episode, but...
I don't believe that it is insincere to create via pastiche.
Okay, that's good.
That's completely legitimate. Like, the multiplicity of things that you can make by recombining ideas that the people who came before you have had is effectively infinite. And so there's no... I don't think there's an iota of shame in doing any of that. That's what, you know, the musical scale is, there are only so many possible sounds that can be made, but reordering them in a certain sequence is what makes a composer a composer. So I don't see why someone who's writing games or someone who is an author should be held to some different standard for it. Because like a game I have might have a matchmaking mechanic, or it might have hit points or something, or it might have strings. Mm-hmm. Those don't degrade what you're creating. But if your approach is to take the thing that came before you and incrementally improve upon it, then that might be something fundamentally different. Like, I like the idea of modifying in terms of a deconstructive sense, where I look at the things that have come before that inspire me, that I really love playing or experiencing, and then I look at the way that they function and I start breaking them apart and taking the elements of it that I find really interesting and recombining them in ways to see what I make. The desire of people to start establishing bright lines between X is a this type thing and Y is a that type thing is super counterproductive to making good things and making more things, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't know when something ceases to be a hack of role-playing games, you know, as they were birthed from chainmail back in the late 70s, or when an Apocalypse World hack becomes something different, because honestly, I had no idea that Apocalypse World existed until I played Monster Hearts. And if that had not been referenced, I would have no clue that was the case. So, I mean, there's something phenomenological about that. But it doesn't matter so much. I mean, I think that the artist should be given his due. Like, Vincent and Meg obviously made an amazing thing. Their new edition is really great. Like, they continue to create. My personal vision as a creator is that everything I make is transient and is perpetually under threat of being stolen from me by another person. And so that is a crushing desperation that continues to move me inevitably to the grave, but in a productive sense. So I guess I just want more people hacking more things, and somewhere in there new things get born. You get that kind of cross-pollination of styles and ideas and genetics that create new species and brand new games. And that's, you know, the kind of stuff we're seeing very aggressively in video games right now. And that's what disappoints me a little bit about analog games is because I feel like there's a little bit of calcification going on about it. And I would like to see more, like, wildness, more, you know, not just more crazy versions of the thing that you've had before, but more, like, bold experiments into new spaces and just ways to recombine things and to go. I understood that these are boundaries that have been raised up before between styles of games, and I don't care because I'm going to smash those boundaries down.
Awesome. Okay. that is good, and that is something I can get behind, and I think that's a good point to... Glenn, who the hell are you?
My name's Glenn. I'm the co-founder of Games by Playdate, which is we're the creators of the game Slash, Romance Without Boundaries, Pack the Pack, and Bad Habit, which are games of various amounts of notoriety. And our latest game is a project called Hearts Blazing, which is a card-driven story game of melodramatic sci-fi adventure where we're trying to get people to make a two-hour version of a season of the sci-fi TV show that they wish existed, right? So
yes,
the ability to kind of recreate Battlestar Galactica or Robotech or like whatever, the kind of stuff that I was my bread and butter as a kid, and just the idea of, and then, you know, Starbuck does this and then she goes there and then they shoot the Cylons and then like that kind of irrationally exuberant storytelling is the point of it. But yeah, so that's, and we're
awesome.
We're centered in southern New Hampshire. It's me, my two co-founders, Dan Bryan and Meg McGinley Crow, who are both far more professional human beings than I am. That's
nice.
That's who we are. Yeah.
But we got you. So that's good.
I'm the one who lets himself get recorded.
Yeah. Is it always you on the Twitter? I know that your username has all three of your names, but I feel like it's always you.
Okay. So yes, it's always me. It's okay. It's almost always me. Every once in a while, sometimes someone else will pop through on the Twitter and then I'll get really surprised because I assume that it's always me. But largely, it's usually me having some kind of emotional meltdown. Yeah, if it doesn't seem like something that was written by a conscious adult, then it's me, which means that most of it is me.
Nice. Yeah. No, it's a good account. I like it.
Yeah.
So I guess before everyone gets worried that suddenly yes. Modifier isn't talking about a role-playing game, first of all, back up about 5 or 6 minutes and listen to the wall-smashing thing again.
Okay.
Because I think this totally fits.
Yeah.
Hearts Blazing, as well as some of the other work that you guys do.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, role-playing games are what walls exist anymore between. You can take this kind of trip from strategic games through weird hybrid games like Time Stories and Winter's Tale, which are like tabletop games, but also story games. And then you get to, like, what the hell is going on in Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective? And then why is there narrative in board games like Pandemic Legacy? And then why is, like, even if you want to get further back and more retro, like, why is there character names in Clue? Like, who gives a shit? Like, all of those things have key elements of role playing in them. And once you've got the foot in the door, you can't draw that bright line. So, like, you can't say, like, oh, well, it's a this and it's not a that. Like, I can add theater to whatever it is I'm doing. That's not to discount the importance of the purity of that form, but I think it's a gradient, right? Like, something is more or less role-playing, whether it has mechanics and materials like an American freeform game is, or whether it is a, you know, a weird, completely live new Magiscola four-day event. Those are points on a gradient, and I don't think that anybody could choose a position on that gradient and go, well, this is where it stops being a role-playing game and starts being X, Y, or Z. And also, that's a really, like, who gives a shit? That's a boring argument. No one gets anything positive about that except the one douchebag who's like, well, I got it right and you didn't. Like, yeah, but like, role-playing has always been something big for me. I ran lots of vampire and mage games. The very first date that I ever had, I got asked out, and because I was young and scared, I was worried about going out with a person. So what I did is that I, like, pivoted and invited them and their friend to join me, and that started a 2-year-long Vampire the Masquerade campaign as an effort to dodge the, like, acuteness of a date.
Oh my god.
And then one night we did the whole, like, Vampire Dark Ages LARP based out of it. And so yeah, like who knows where this shit comes from? But and that's fed very much into stuff like Slash and stuff like Hearts Blazing, where we want people to have the freedom to create the detail and agency of story that they're interested in, but not feel beholden to a certain plane of that, right?
Yeah.
Like sometimes, I think one of the main concerns that people have about like the various iterations of Dungeons and Dragons is that they feel that the game is asking them to commit to a certain level of improvisation or characterization. And that's not something that's comfortable to everybody. And that's fine. Sure. if that discussion has been had beforehand. But in a weird way, there are some indie games that are better at getting everybody involved than something as tried and true as Dungeons and Dragons is, even through all the tropes and establishments D&D has. So, like, I find it infinitely easier to introduce people to Fiasco than Dungeons and Dragons, because I don't have to be like, okay, listen, it's dragons, and there's this eyeball monster. And like, I don't have to like defend that preemptively, which is, I guess, a trope of the form. But I don't have to be like, yeah, and then you roll dice and then you hit and I do 5 points of damage to you. Like, you never have to have that discussion with them when you're talking about Fiasco. You're just like, dude, do you like heist movies where everything gets fucked up? I have an evening for you. Like, we're going to do that. It's going to be silly and dumb. And I think in the last game of Fiasco I played, the characters ended up recording pornography in the Arctic Circle.
Of course.
Yeah, like you do.
Yeah, okay.
So we didn't kill any beholders, but...
You had a much more relatable experience.
Right? It shouldn't be, but it is. It is a much more... It is a much more relatable because of, you know, Jason Morningstar's, you know, elegance.
Oh my God.
Like, yeah. His ability to create something that provides you only the pieces that you need and nothing more. Nothing to, like, really burden you, which I'm beginning to see as more and more and more important when it comes to writing rules.
Yeah.
Yeah, God. So games.
So games. We're going to talk about your game.
All right. Okay.
So Hearts Blazing, which is kickstarting right now. Even when this episode comes out, the Kickstarter will still be happening. Yep. So you should get in on it. Oh, so you told us a little bit about Hearts Blazing, inspired by some of the shows that you watched in your youth and the enthusiasm of telling people about them, which I definitely relate to that. So why sci-fi in particular?
So when we made Hearts Blazing, we made it at, there's a convention in Maine called PortCon Maine. It's in South Portland, and it's fun. It's small. It's about 2,500 people, maybe. And we do a panel every year called Make a Game with Games by Playdate. And we go in and we, over the course of an hour, generate a brand new game from nothing.
Wow.
Yeah, it's largely fueled by caffeine and bad decisions. The idea is to get people into the mindset that it doesn't have to be good, right? You just do it. You just go. And that, and this is something that all of the writers that I admire understand, which is that you're never writing the novel the first time you put the pen to the paper. You got to revise and revise and revise. You got to edit and edit and edit. And the barrier to entry seems, especially in games, it seems so high and so esoteric because you think you need to know all of these things before you can trace from A to B to C. And that's just not the case. Mm-hmm. Like, any idiot monkey can make a game. I'm living proof, right? Like, it's not hard to do it. It's hard to do it beautifully, but it's not hard to do it. So we do this thing, and we were at PortCon Maine, and PortCon Maine is a very youthful convention. It's very anime-focused, and so I immediately, during this panel, started thinking about stuff that was interesting to me at the time. I think I'd been rewatching Battlestar Galactica, and I've always been a huge fan of Neon Genesis Evangelion and Robotech and those kinds of, like... long form anime war stories. So we started to make this role playing game about it. And there are role playing games that exist that are of that theme. But also in my car, I keep a copy of The Quiet Year on my passenger seat of my car to remind me that I'll never make anything as good as that.
Oh no.
But what I really dug about it was the tempo mechanic of the cards, right? Because it,
yes,
it pulls you forward and keeps you in place in the story, which is really important when it comes to collaborative storytelling. Because if you don't have a person who's setting the stage for you, it can be really easy to just fly really far ahead. And then all of a sudden you're past where kind of your heart wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so Avery's idea of having this deck that kind of tempos you through the seasons was really important in my mind at the time and still now. And so we created this idea of, okay, well, what if we have a deck of cards that represent like different episodes of this TV series? Of like, there's the episode where all the power's gone out and you're being hunted in the dark, or there's the episode yeah. where like, no, we've run out of fuel, or like, there are these super almost meta narrative tropes in adventure sci-fi specifically that show up, whether it's like Farscape, Robotech, you know, Battlestar Galactica, Star Trek, Star Wars, like this, you just you yep. see this shit in season after season, episode after episode, the same types of characters with a different remix or the same stories in a different telling. And that's, again, no shade to that. Like, that's great. Like, I love those things. But we wanted to boil it down to those meta narrative elements and go, listen, here's what's really happening, right? Like, you have something hunting you in the dark. And that's the core of this story. And so there's your antagonist, and now go. And like, the other thing that we were really thinking of at the time is that one of our concerns with indie games and with story games is that, again, that barrier to entry is really high because of there's an embarrassment factor to it, right? Like, the idea that your ideas are not as good as other people's ideas,
mm-hmm.
or that you will draw a blank and then sit there, you know, twiddling your thumbs while everyone's looking at you waiting for you to contribute. Like, that is that's a terrible feeling. That's like forgetting your lines on stage. Like, if I make a game and someone has that feeling, I have like really seriously failed to provide them with the armament that they need to succeed. That's not the fact that they're not creative, because we are all very, very, very creative. We all dream. We all come up with weird fantasies that make us do stupid things or say things on Twitter.
So how does Hearts Blazing help that? How does it, you know, give these people what they need to contribute?
So the idea of Hearts Blazing is that you have these archetypes and you have these episodes, and they prompt you, they suggest to you, they provide you a safety net of ideas. So like, I want you to do crazy acrobatic flips on the trapeze with your crazy science fiction ideas. But if you just in that second don't have it, it's pretty much always okay to unblinkingly walk away from a fiery explosion. Like, that's totally totally acceptable. Like,
nice.
When it comes to like all the things that are going to happen over the next 2 hours, your micro pause of ideas in this moment is insignificant. And so like, don't worry. Don't worry so much about it. It's okay. We've got you. And so I just want to provide the Hearts Blazing is a toolkit of ideas, suggestions, and structure that allows people to kind of plow forward, generally moving in the same direction. Because, I mean, it's not just all total freeform nonsense. There is a direction to it. There is some mechanics to it, but that is also like the idea that a funnel creates, you know, an increased pressure of the water. That's the reason that those mechanics are there.
Yeah, well, let's talk about the mechanics for a minute then. So you've got archetypes. So each person playing chooses an archetype character.
Yeah. So those are things like your favorite characters from sci-fi TV or movies are people like Han Solo or Gaius Baltar is another one of my favorites, or Rick Hunter from Robotech, and or Major Kusanagi. And these are all really, when you boil it down, in our minds, they boil down to things like, well, there tends to be a leader figure.
Mm-hmm.
There tends to be a figure that represents like institutional knowledge, like the engineer or like Geordi or whatever. There tends to be someone who has just seen all of this shit before and just knows what to do. So, you know, like Worf, Chewbacca, any kind of like lunk or whatever, anybody who's been through the suck before, there tends to be the character who is preternaturally good at their job, who is, you know, maybe they're Iceman from Top Gun or Max Sterling from Robotech, or they're just an incomparable ace. Pilot. And then there tends to be the new guy. And usually when it comes to TVs and movies, the new guy is the audience's entry into it. But we wanted to make sure that not everybody had to play the new guy. So we have like these ideas of like, there's a rookie, there's a leader, there's a veteran, there's an engineer, and there's an ace. And maybe not all of them are there, but some mixture of those archetypes exist. And those are the characters that will propel you through, that will propel you through the stories. And usually it turns out to be that those characters go through some similar types of, you know, character arcs. The rookie goes through some kind of harrowing through which they go from being a farm boy to being, you know, the pilot who blows up the Death Star. These things happen over and over and over and over again. And I did not invent any of them. So just clearly calling them out and going, listen, this is when Arthur pulls the sword from the stone and then learns all this shit from Merlin, like that's okay for your character to do that. Let's have fun thinking of the way in which the sword is in the stone, or what that sword means, or like, what is your Death Star? Like, what is your guidance from Obi-Wan Kenobi? Mm-hmm. Or what is your season 3 of Robotech cover for your insurrection where you're a band? I don't really understand season 3.
Who knows?
One of the things we discovered with Slash is that providing language that that the non-geek or the lay person could connect with is really, really important, because you're probably surrounded by equally geeky people. I make this assumption.
On a pretty regular basis, but not always, yes.
So one of the negative elements of geek culture is the constant challenging of one another's knowledge about esoteric things, right?
Yep.
It's like the least attractive thing. So completely unsexy. So we want to make things that say, listen, that's okay. Because anybody who's going to put you on blast for not knowing what happened in season 5 of Star Trek The Next Generation, there is something that they don't know about also. And that's okay. And you're not worse than them for not knowing it. And they're not better than you because they did know it. They're just being a complete fucking tool right now. So, like, let's make a thing where instead of, like, capping your brilliance, what we're going to do is we're just going to raise the foundation up so that everybody starts working at the same level of, listen, we're all having a good time here. We're all making this story, riffing on things that we all understand. And so with Slash, we realized that we could do that by making pop culture reference and going, you know who this character is. And if you don't know who this character is, that's cool. Draw a new character. And with Heart's Blazing, we do it with the archetypes or with the kind of plots that are semi-universal, where you're like, yeah, of course you've seen that episode before. That's the one where they opened up the mummy's tomb and then they got cursed and then they had to figure out how to deal with it. Like, yes, that happens. That's okay.
Yeah, I was reading through some of the episode synopsis on the print and play version, and I could look at each one that I read and go, okay, I know which episode of Firefly that is, or I know which Star Trek that is.
Yeah, and that's like, the more you examine popular culture and storytelling, the more you see that it is that these themes repeat over and over and over again.
And even extending outside of sci-fi TV shows too, like of these are a little more specific, but generally, yeah, it's serial television. They're going to hit the same notes.
Yeah, exactly. We wanted to ground it in something, like we wanted to corridor it so that people could kind of move forward with it.
Mm-hmm.
But like, sometimes if you make something too broad and too wide open, it dilutes momentum. And what we were finding through the playtesting of Heart's Blazing was that momentum was super important to having fun. If you're not burning through episodes in 5 to 10 minutes, you're taking too long. There's too many questions. This is like a from the hip kind of game. You know, like, nice. don't think. I mean, I guess generally in most of the games I make, it's don't think. God, thinking is so boring. Like, that's why you have a game. Someone else did the thinking for you.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's why it's structured in that way, to preserve the momentum, to give you that familiarity that allows you to have confidence, right? Because I don't know if you've ever done theater, but like, one of the tricks to being on stage is that, you know, you're supposed to memorize all your lines, right? But But really what happens is you don't memorize your lines. You memorize the last thing that the other person says. So like you're really memorizing cues, and cues take up a lot less mental space than the entire litany of whatever your script is. So if you're just worried about creating a good, easily rememberable shorthand, that's a far more effective and will get a far better performance out of you than if someone just memorizes every single cadence of every single word that they say. And sometimes it'll not work, and that's okay. But most of the times you'll get really great performances because people will unclench and it will be less of a reading and more of a inhabitance and more of a performance of that part. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I like that.
I think a while ago, who is it? Like Philip Seymour Hoffman and I can see his face. He's the guy who plays Dr. Steve Brule. He's a comedic actor. He was in Step Brothers. He was in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Oh, fuck.
You know who I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
So they did a stage play where what they did is every few nights they would completely switch roles with each other and just take each other's role, which is, on one hand, seems kind of crazy. On the other hand, in the terms of like LARP games, yeah, okay, totally, yeah. Like we're gonna swap roles. I'm gonna give you this hat and you're gonna be me, and it's not that radical of an idea. But they would do it, and they would get, because they understood the perspective of the other characters and they knew the cues and they knew what they were doing, they didn't need to know every single word of the script, but they got really amazing performances, which created really great experiences for the audience. And that's something that I think translates to games, where the idea is not do you make something perfect, it's do you allow there to be a great experience for the people playing the thing.
Yeah.
Is that too, like, is this too bird's eye view?
No, that's perfect. I actually, you know, having not played Hearts Blazing, I was looking through the rules today, and I knew from watching the Kickstarter about the archetypes. You know, you play these five different types of character, but you've got mechanics in place to even shake that up a little bit too. So it's not just, okay, I played the leader last time, you know, I know what's coming with that one. I'll play a different role, which is good for people to switch up those roles, but you've got motives that make them different too.
So a lot of the stuff we put into the game is not placeholder. What's that? So like there are points in the game, mm-hmm. right? So like there's this idea that you collect keywords, and then at the end of the game, if you have the most keywords, you get the last word in the game, right? Like you get to your personal victory for playing the best out of everyone, for playing the hardest out of all the people at the table, is that you get to have the final say in how this story turns out. So that's all like that's just a ruse. It's just an excuse to get people playing, right?
Sure.
Because there are players who are super into points and winning.
Mm-hmm.
And there are players who are super into, they don't give a fuck about that, and they just mm-hmm. want to have that experience. It's I can't remember the name of the guy who broke it down, but he was talking about massive multiplayer online role-playing games, and that there are achievers, conquerors, explorers, and socializers. Like that there are different reasons that people engage in games. Sometimes it's to defeat the system. Sometimes it's to leverage the system to best other players. Sometimes it's to explore the permutations of the system. Or sometimes it's a vehicle through which you socialize with other players, right? So it's these different priorities. And so that's something that when I'm making games, especially any that have any kind of real social interaction component, I think about, like, how do I get all four of those types of players in?
Yeah.
Like, how do I not, because I don't want a game that's just I am better at this game than you are, because that game is chess, and it's really hard to design a better chess than chess.
Yeah.
They did a really good job making chess, if you love chess.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want to like compete with those things. I just want to make sure that everybody sitting at the table has a way into the experience. And that kind of comes through in the feedback. We got all this feedback from playtesters, and what's like, when I stepped back from it a little bit, I started looking at it and going, oh, wow. All the LARPers and story game players wanted me to take out the mechanics of the game, and all of the tabletop and like traditional role-playing game people wanted me to take out the mutability and the narrative aspects of it. And I was like, oh, I should not have asked any of you to do this. Like, this is a bad idea. Like, it's, what's the, you know, if the only tool you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, like when I talked a little bit before about the kind of calcifying of games, if you just keep riffing on the same foundations over and over and over again, you may not realize how narrow your field of view is becoming, right? Like, there's, I think one of the things that's really great about the Atlantic Ocean and that separates American freeform games from like Nordic LARPing is literally that distance and the amount of time it took for things to really translate over, that people came at this story game idea from completely different points, right? Like from totally different directions. So like the Nordic LARP people seem to come at it from an experimental theater angle, and the American freeform designers came at it from like a 70s role-playing game thing, right? Mm-hmm. So it's much more mechanically influenced on the American side. But this is my feeling about it.
We got to have points, Glenn. We don't know what to do if there aren't any points in this game.
Well, I've made that argument. Like, it's not a game if it doesn't have points.
Yeah.
It needs to have some kind of points. You need to win a thing, even if the thing you win is that you had a good time. You need to be able to write that down, check mark. Yes, I had a good time. I've beaten the game.
Yep. It's fine if the points don't matter as long as they're there.
Exactly. And so that's been one of the weird complications, is that there is all of this stuff in, just like in Slash, in Hearts Blazing, that just does not matter at all.
Yeah.
And just, we try really hard to reiterate that point and be like, listen, dude, like, if it works for you, yeah, great, awesome, high five, let's go. But if it doesn't work for you, don't stop on my account. Like, I don't know you, you do you. Like, make the game, I'm trying to help you have a great evening. Don't get bogged down in my details if you have great ideas. Because that's not the problem I'm trying to solve. The problem I'm trying to solve is that there are more people who should be playing games, and they're scared of it because they see people who are really good at playing games and they don't want to compete with them, or they don't feel like they can be at the same level as them, or they don't feel comfortable around them. And that's a blind spot for the good game players.
Yeah.
Right? Like the like should be more cognizant of potential new players, and they should be more inviting to them. And one of the ways you do that is you make games that have mechanics that ask more people and comfort more people to come in, and ask the people who are experienced to be like, listen, be a fucking grown up about it. Let's have a good evening with people that you didn't think that you could have a good evening with. That's a beautiful goal.
I admire that goal. That was a good goal.
Yeah, we're excited about
good.
It. We like it.
Well, I'm excited. I want to try to play this. Just looking over how the points play into it, it's definitely encouraging somebody to play their archetype along a particular motivation, which could be very interesting. You know, if somebody is very dedicated to getting those points, then to me, it seems like they're, by virtue of that mechanic, dedicated to playing their character in a particular way. Would you disagree?
No, I would totally disagree with you. But that might be because I'm not seeing it from an outside perspective. Mm-hmm. So generally when it comes to design, if someone tells me that this is a way that my game works, and if my response is, no, you're playing it wrong, I stop myself and go, no, I've fucked up at some point, because either I was not communicating what it is intended to be, or it's not providing you the tools to get to that point, right? So like, I don't believe that the archetypes are meant to be married to specific motivations.
But you get a motivation. There are five.
Oh yeah, no, you get the motivation, and the idea is that the archetype describes how you do things, and the motivation describes why you do things.
Right.
Because I felt like that was something more approachable than like alignments. Right. Because mm-hmm. like, I'm good versus I'm bad.
Right.
Is really silly, because the best characters are the ones who are like neither. And really when it comes down to it, especially in sci-fi episodic stuff, it really is, how selfish are you? Like, how how much do you care about yourself versus everybody else? And so like Gaius Baltar, for instance, super duper selfish, but Captain Picard, super duper unselfish. That's really the, also it's not a spectrum, it's more of a circle, because there are multiple ways to get from the nadir to the zenith of that.
Yeah. So you've got motives: opportunist, survivor, guardian, savior. Savior and Avenger that each have two key phrases they're looking, or two keywords.
Yeah, and again, these are largely irrelevant phrases that we picked to kind of to motivate people, but to, you know, it's bait. It's all just bait to get you into that story. The idea that, like, the Avenger is a character who's an Avenger is someone who is, like, post-Wrath of Khan, Captain Kirk, who is motivated by revenge, and they want to strike back at the person who hurt them. Mm-hmm. A character like a Savior, as opposed to a Guardian, like, a Guardian is someone who is looking to maintain the prosperity and status quo of the group, but a Savior is a person who's looking to kind of transcend what they are and become more. Like, there is something quasi-religious about a Savior type figure. So, like, in a Battlestar Galactica sense, again, like, I drew a lot of this stuff from these different shows, Adama is a Guardian, but Roslyn is a Savior. Like, they're...
Gotcha, yeah.
And that's a lot of the way that we think about this game, and a lot of our games, is in using shorthand from popular media, because it's really useful, and also helps get people interested in your game, because that's a convenient on-ramp for them, and then they can make really amazing games of their own. But, like, we've said, listen, you can get on this highway by going, dude, do you remember Battlestar Galactica? All right, whatever, we're gonna do that. It's like, we're people in space, and there's robots hunting us. Or the world is a post-apocalypse, and we are people who have escaped the harem of this post-apocalyptic overlord, and we don't know where we're going, but we're getting away. Like, all of that window dressing on those stories, that's how ideally it's all supposed to come together. Whether or not it's a big hot mess, I guess, is up in the air.
My understanding then is you've got your archetype, you've got your motive, and each of these episode cards have, you know, you're bidding on these episodes to win the keywords, which are the point, which are a lie. But is that any kind of, like, are you contractually obligated to play your character towards that motivation?
I mean, I'm not going to come to your house and, like, smack you if you don't, but...
Well, then what's the point?
Okay, well, we feel like it is in the best interest of the balance of the game to play it with these motivations and these archetypes.
Okay.
It's definitely in the spirit of, like, episodic science fiction. This is a spread of emotions and tropes that you see repeated over and over and over again, and I don't want to reinvent the wheel on it. But the idea behind the keywords is that you're bidding on the keywords. You're attempting to kind of be the high bidder so that you can then own those keywords, because at the end of the game, if you've collected the most of your keywords, you have final say on how the epilogue of the story goes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know the right way to say it, so I'll just say it bluntly. Like, the players who want to get the most points are not as interested in getting the most points as much as they are interested in denying points to other people. So they're not as interested in winning as they are in other people's defeat.
I see that, yeah.
And so, all right, that's cool. Like, the idea of rewarding them with the, well, you get to tell everyone that it was all a dream at the end. Seems like a relatively satiating, but ultimately a harmless, you know, gift to those players.
Yeah.
They get to feel good about their winning and their triumph, and everybody else still had a good time, and everybody can walk away from the table not feeling like they've wasted an evening.
Fair. So, points aside, are the keywords, are they something that you're encouraged to work into that episode? So, for anybody who hasn't already looked up this print and play, the first one on the list here is a pilot episode, Milk Run. It has a little description. You're better than this, and they know it, but even the best have to run patrol every once in a while, and you've got keywords, safety, honor, and triumph. Are you encouraged to, like, incorporate those themes?
If you can work those themes in, that's great. If you can't, that's okay. Sometimes it's really hard in games to present opportunities to people, because they think that if they don't take the opportunities that they have, that they're somehow losing, right? Like, like, if I didn't make the most out of that moment or that resource, then I have slipped back. I have been defeated by some potential version of myself that did everything perfectly. And that's insane. I would love it if people the things that are written on the cards are our ideas of the shit that happens in these stories. And sometimes they're really fun. But we also recognize that if you try and jam every single one of them in, you're just going to have a weird, unsatisfying mutant baby that's not going to be cool. Like,
yeah, that's its own episode.
Yeah. Like, we'd rather you take the ones that fit and work them in, and not, as long as you don't feel bad because you didn't work something in, we're okay. That's the goal. The goal is use it if it speaks to you. If it doesn't speak to you, that's all right, dude. Let's just, come on, we're going to have a good evening. The goal of all games is to have a good evening, right? Like, even if you're playing a game that's not ostensibly fun, even if it's like a weird, harrowing meditation on the nature of mortality and like affliction, there is something cathartic and resonant about doing it. Like, that's why you're doing it. You're trying to have some kind of great experience. I don't want to cock block you from that experience with my stupid rules and requirements. I want my game to be a wingman to a great evening for you.
I like that. Oh.
It's probably not perfect. I'm cool with that. I think it's doing something a little bit different, and that really is what excites me about it.
Every game that, like, it made me think of, you know, I looked at it and I was like, yes, but it's doing it so much differently, or in a lot of cases, so much better than
thank you.
Those other games that I can think of. Or, yeah, or in such a different way that, like, it doesn't fucking matter if it's better or not. It's different, and it looks really exciting.
I want more stuff like that. Like, I've started, I printed out all the Golden Cobras from the past 2 years. So that's like 1,200 pages of LARP rules.
Jesus. Yeah.
And I'm going through and editing all of them.
Oof. Okay. Why?
For fun. This is a project I gave myself, which is to like go through each of these things and go, what if we did this? Or what if, you know, why is that the choice that's made here? Like, you know, not just in the how do I play it, or sometimes it's like, okay, but I have this like rules question here that needs clarification. But usually it's like, well, why am I limited to these choices? And then from there, I pivot to how does that impact my evening? Right? Like, how does that impact my enjoyment of it? Because one of the metrics I use for my games is if you're running my game and I have to stop you and explain to you the way that it should be, my game's not done. It's just not finished, right? Like, it's that would be like if I gave you a meal and like I had cooked most of it.
Like, yeah.
And I go, no, that fish is supposed to be raw because blah, 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 blah. Like, yeah, maybe we could make it work in that moment, but I don't want you to eat that meal. Like, I don't think that's a good reflection on my skills. I don't think that's the best experience you could be getting eating that meal. Like, that's a failure of your experience, and it's a failure of your experience because it's a failure on my part as a chef. So I don't know exactly how I got to that point, but yes.
That's okay.
That is my perpetual anxiety. But yeah, you know, games.
Games. So how did Slash come about?
So I'm relatively adjacent to Boston, and Boston is the host of PAX East, which is a very, very, very large convention, about 70 plus thousand people.
It is ridiculous.
And in 2013, me and some of my World of Warcraft guildmates rented out a house in South Boston for PAX, which, if you haven't done it, I totally recommend doing. Like, yeah. Airbnb-ing an entire house is so much better than a hotel. Oh my God. And at that time, towards the end of my decade-long stint in print media, my business partner, Dan, also had been doing print magazines and printing and things like that. And Cards Against Humanity had made a really big splash. And we had a lot of tension with that product because we thought it was fun, but also were turned off by the down-punching and hypocrisy of it.
Yep.
Because, like, nothing says progressive values like 9 white dudes. So we wanted something that wouldn't get boring. And we loved fan fiction stuff and like, storytelling things. And we were super getting into Fiasco. And so it was, like, at the same time, we were, like, playing Fiasco and also playing Cards Against Humanity. We're like, listen, there's something. Every time we play Cards Against Humanity, it gets less fun. Because we keep hearing the same jokes over and over again. And then they make us feel weird. And then we don't want to hear those jokes anymore. But then we can't play Fiasco in 30 minutes. Right? It just straight up takes too fucking long.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, but I need to set an entire evening aside. So, like, what if we made something that did both? And so, you know, from there, like, we were like, oh, fan fiction, isn't it funny when Optimus Prime has sex with RoboCop? Yeah, that's great. You got the touch! So, so we had rented this house for PAX. The night or two before PAX, we were like, what if we did this? And we came up with this huge list of characters, 300 or 400 characters. And then over the course of an evening, we ended up writing basically the entire game. And then I drove back to New Hampshire and then I printed it out in the print shop that I worked at, cut it and brought it back to PAX East, and then took it all around the convention as like basically a box of 400 business cards, and then showed it to people. And we had 5 or 6 people try and buy it from us just immediately. Yeah. And we were like, oh, okay, so there's something here. And then we had 2 people who were lawyers who were like, you can never do this because this is a terrible idea.
And you said, watch me.
Oh, yeah? I'm going to quit my job and do this. So, yeah, and then we did the fundraising for it, and everything after that has been pretty good. So, as of last week, we were in Oprah Magazine for this game, which is weird.
Yeah.
Bizarrely mainstream for a game about, like, Mega Man kissing Dracula. so that's... Yeah, it's pretty crazy.
I'm mad that nobody told me about this game sooner, but I'm glad I heard about it before Oprah did. So
that's what's, I mean, it's my entire life, right? Or it's half of my entire life. I still run into people who are like, how does this, my friend, my co-founder, Meg, was just in Vegas where there was a giant, like, romance literature convention of like 50, 60,000 people. Mm-hmm. And they were like, yeah, they never heard of this game. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me? Why am I working another job? This is insane.
Yes.
And this, like, a lot of the people, like Joshua Newman, Epidiah, Emily Care Boss, and you know, Vincent and Meg and stuff, like, they make these really amazing experiences. There is something about their humbleness and their demeanor and their desire for their things to be private and small that saddens me so much. It's like, no, you're making really beautiful things that maybe one day I could make something as good as. Why the fuck are you not selling it to 1 million people? Like, why are you not spreading it across the land? Like, this is not an inaccessible. Like, these games are not inaccessible.
Right.
There's some kind of problem with delivery mechanism or marketing or whatever. Just like, come on. Like, we could be transforming popular culture with these systems. But yeah.
Yeah, I feel like board games have been on the rise for years now. You know, we're seeing them take over more and more real estate in stores, Target and Barnes & Noble and all this stuff. They're taking over so much of that floor space that why aren't games like these there? Why aren't they in the public space?
My favorite video game right now is a card game. What the fuck is that? Like, my two favorite video games are card games. Like, the Pathfinder Adventures game for the iPad is great, and it is completely obnoxious to play in physical form because it requires so much, like, reshuffling of card decks. Mm-hmm. But, like, it is perfect as a video game, and then I play a shit ton of Netrunner online, and just, like, I don't know what it is about the separate subcultures of life, video games, role-playing games, tabletop games, like why they are so, like, why they repel other elements of their brother and sister subcultures so much. But it is really detrimental.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there'd be a lot of really terrible messes of, like, people making plays that incorporate a lot of video, and that usually never turns out really well. But maybe sometimes it would be amazing, and, you know, maybe really great things could be made, like video games. Like, think of all there's like dating sim video games that are really cool, and those are
they're so good.
They're kind of like you know, those are super LARPy. Like there's, yeah. like there is all of this cross-pollination, but like no one will ever admit to it. Mm-hmm. Like, and no one will say, yeah, I'm going to take this idea from, I'm going to make Dota the role-playing game and $1 million fucking dollars. Like that's cool. Like do that. Like, take it. Take that structure. Take that idea. Take the lessons that they learned. Like the shit that doesn't work. Pay attention to that more than the stuff that works. And then, you know, tweak it, try it, remix it, and make your thing. It's especially in analog games, in LARP and stuff like that, the cost to get something out is so freakishly low. Like you can basically work like a summer job and publish something groundbreaking. It really doesn't take a lot of money, especially compared to something like AAA video games or whatever. It is a rich and wide open field for innovation and growth, and it's weird that because I think my belief, because of the demeanor of the people who are creating, they are artificially restraining its growth.
That's fair.
I don't know.
That's probably a good note, actually. Well, first of all, the Kickstarter, which is still going, is available for Hearts Blazing. It's very straightforward. You back it and you get the game.
Yep. And our experience has been that people just want the thing. So make the thing.
I like how straightforward that is.
I like it too. I would like more people to back it because I think they would dig it.
Well, they should go back it because it's a cool looking game. And I backed it. So get to it.
Thank you very much. Back it once, back it twice, back it three times. There's a link to that, and the video's up at gamesbyplaydate. And you can also watch me have a mental breakdown at gamesbyplaydate. It's usually pretty entertaining, though.
It's a recurring theme.
It's pretty good. Yeah, it's like you can watch throughout the course of a day for, like, there's this poignancy moment that I get into in the day. And then, like, later at night, there's the why is living moment.
It gets very real on twitter.com, so come hang out with us.
And also we'll be at me and my partners will be at Dreamation. We're going to be at Aresia in Boston in January of next year. We're not doing Gen Con because that convention maybe harbors sexual predators and other terrible things, but so we're all over the place, and if you ever want to come see us, I'll give you a high five. And
cool, well, thanks for hanging out with me.
Meg, thank you very much for walking down this terrible dark alley with me.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks again to Glenn for coming on the show and waxing philosophical about games with me. If you want to hear more, he's at Games by Playdate on Twitter. You can find a link to the Hearts Blazing Kickstarter in the show notes or at gamesbyplaydate.com. Their website also has information on how to buy or print any of their other games, and they're well worth checking out. There's also a link in the show notes to the one-shot Twitch stream of Hearts Blazing so you can get a feel for how the game is played. That's it for this week, heroes. You can find Modifier on Twitter at Modifier Podcast or at the headquarters at modifierpodcast.tumblr.com. You can send comments, questions, or contribution suggestions to modifierpodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, please consider leaving a review on iTunes, as that helps more people find us. Modifier is a proud member of the One Shot Podcast Network, an amazing family of RPG podcasts that includes incredible shows like One Shot, Campaign, Backstory, and Talking Tabletop. Modifier's theme music was created by my favorite Bothan, Kat Greenfield, whose myriad talents are on display at katgreenfield.com. Next time on Modifier, I'll be talking to Tim Brown about translating Germany's most popular RPG, The Dark Eye. See you then!